Hello and welcome to the podcast of The Life Scientific, first broadcast on BBC Radio 4. I'm Jamal Khalili and my mission is to interview the most fascinating and important scientists alive today and to find out what makes them tick. My guest today is unusual in that her area of study barely existed when she first started working in it just 12 years ago. Since then, she's been responsible for an explosion of research in the field. Sarah Jane Blakemore is Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London and is fascinated by the teenage brain. Until recently, it was thought that brain development is all over by early childhood, but it's her discoveries that have helped reveal the intricate and vast changes the adolescent brain still has to make on the way to adulthood. She's passionate that teenagers shouldn't be demonised or made the butt of jokes, but instead should have our sympathy, and that we should examine carefully how we teach and nurture them. Sarah Jane Blakemore, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Of course, your research is into the workings of the adolescent brain, but what is it about the teenage experience in more general that interests you so much?
I'm really interested in teenage typical behaviours or adolescent typical behaviours, things like heightened self-consciousness, this feeling of acute embarrassment we have when we're teenagers, especially in front of our parents. I'm also interested in things like risk-taking, this increased propensity for teenagers to take risks, and peer influence. If you look at when teenagers take those risks, it's normally when they're with their friends, not when they're on their own. And often in talks, I like to pick out examples of these teenage typical behaviours. And one example is from a letter that was written to the Guardian newspaper a couple of years ago. So this is a reader writing into the Guardian, and she says, "There's nothing like teenage diaries for putting momentous historical events in perspective. This is my entry for the 20th of July, 1969. I went to Art Centre by myself in yellow cords and blouse. Ian was there, but he didn't speak to me. Got rhyme put in my handbag from someone who's apparently got a crush on me. It's Nicholas, I think. Man landed on moon." That's just a really nice example of how, you know, for this particular teenage girl, what's important to her at that moment in time are things like what she's wearing, who she likes, who she doesn't like. The fact that man landed on moon that day is less important.
And that's quite real and perfectly valid for them, that their world, that is more important. And
it
we should acknowledge that.
This is a period of life where the sense of self, and particularly the sense of social self, how other people see you, undergoes really profound transition. It's absolutely critical that teenagers go through this period of sort of discovering themselves, their identity, their moral beliefs, their political beliefs, their fashion interests, their music taste, who they hang out with, what peer groups they're in. That's what adolescence is for.
Well, you now run your own lab of scientists. You've won many awards. You already have a wealth of world-class research to your name. But can I ask you to take us back to the teenage Sarah Jane Blakemore? What were you like at school?
I was a pretty typical teenager. I was at a very high-achieving academic girls' school in Oxford. I wasn't particularly academic at school, actually. I was a little bit naughty, although not as naughty as my sisters.
In what way were you naughty?
Oh, just, you know, usual teenage misbehaviour. Nothing serious, but just things like, you know, hiding in cupboards and that kind of thing, messing around with my friends. And I wasn't actually very academic. And I think my teachers just, you know, kind of almost gave up on me. But I became really interested in learning quite late. So when I was probably when I was doing my A-levels was the first time that I really suddenly understood why it was important and really interesting to learn. And then I did well. But before that, I was, you know, just a really normal teenager going out with my friends. My friends were just, you know, the most important thing in my life. And also, of course, boys.
What sort of things did you get up to? Were you rebellious?
I was a little bit rebellious. I used to do as much as I possibly could to persuade my parents to let me go out as much as possible with my friends.
Parties, raves?
Yeah, parties, raves, a few raves. Oxford was the centre of the rave scene when I was a teenager.
Yeah. And?
It was fun.
Your parents knew about this, presumably?
Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing. I think they did. At this point, I was 16, so I was a little bit older, and I think they just trusted me and allowed me that independence, which I really appreciate.
You say you weren't that academic at school, but there were early signs, weren't there, of your emerging passion for the subject of psychology. When you were just 15, you found yourself some interesting work experience.
Yes. Yeah, so when I was 15, in my school, we were all required to do a week's work experience somewhere. And earlier that year, a psychologist, Professor Peter Bryant, whose daughter was at our school, had come in to give a talk about his work on dyslexia. This is my memory. He happened to have a book in his bag, which was called Autism, Explaining the Enigma by Uta Frith. And he gave me this book, and I became totally fascinated in developmental psychology and particularly developmental disorders like dyslexia and autism. And I wrote to Uta Frith and asked her if I could do a week's work experience with her. And with characteristic generosity, she allowed me to do that. So I went up to London and I spent a week in her lab. It just absolutely had the biggest impact on me out of everything that I did during my schooling.
That ignited your passion for the subject.
That was when I knew that I wanted to do psychology at university, and I never looked back.
Well, of course, you grew up in a scientific household. Your father is the prominent neuroscientist Sir Colin Blakemore, who was one of the early guests on this programme. But your whole family received constant threats because of his research on animals. Can you paint a picture of the kind of things that happened that you had to go through?
Yeah, I haven't ever really talked about this before. I've always avoided the subject and skirted around the issue because it's such a big deal. But so when we were growing up, we were under the constant threat from animal rights. And I could talk about it for a long time because there was just so much of it. But I should give you a few examples. There were kidnapping threats against us, which were taken very seriously by the police, such that me and my two little sisters, when we walked to school, I mean, our school was only a few blocks away, but the police would follow us to school every day. That's because of the kidnapping threat. That went on for quite a long time. It became worse and worse. I mean, it firstly started with the animal rights people sending horrible letters with razor blades in, that kind of thing, to my dad at his work. But then it very much centred on our house and our home. So every Saturday they would organise demonstrations in Oxford that would start at my parents' house with hundreds or even thousands of people from around the country coming. You know, the police got wind of this, so every Saturday our whole road was cordoned off by the police and the police on horseback at either end. This is a really huge nuisance to our neighbours who couldn't, you know, get out and into their driveways. It's just the sort of, yeah, the publicness of it was really hard. I mean, they did things like smash our windows and put paint strip on our cars and those kinds of tactics, but ultimately it culminated in them sending us a letter bomb. I was actually already at university at this point, but I was back at home for Christmas, and they sent a package that looked like a Christmas present in a kind of poster tube size package. And I picked it up thinking it was for me, so I was expecting something. Luckily, I saw it was for my dad. I put it under a table and he didn't get back until late. He didn't notice it. And then the next morning at 5 a.m, the police phoned and said, if you get a package, don't open it because a few bombs have been sent around. And there was a bomb in that package.
Wow. Goodness me. So yeah. This is quite serious. This isn't just idle, nasty emails or nasty, threatening letters.
It was very, very serious. But what was interesting about it was that for us, it was normal. We didn't know any different, my sisters and I. It's hard to explain how we weren't actually frightened, really. It was so normal for us that we didn't live in the constant fear that it sounds like we should have lived in, because we didn't know any different.
And there must have been occasions when you were frightened, though, quite genuinely scared.
Yeah, there were. So when they were outside our house, we just couldn't go out, and it was pretty scary. Objectively, it's very scary, but we weren't living in a constant state of fear. And I think that's partly because my parents didn't show fear. They must have been really scared, but they didn't show us their fear, which I think was probably a really good thing for us.
And you're grateful to them for having that strength and shielding you, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they did talk about it a lot, but they talked about it in a very thought-through, sort of academic way about the pros and cons of animal experimentation and the reasons why the animal rights people were there, that kind of thing, rather than not in an emotional way at all. They didn't instill fear in us.
And it was while you were doing your degree, experimental psychology in Oxford, that you started to become interested in schizophrenia. Why was this disorder so interesting to you?
Experimental psychology at Oxford is an amazing course. I mean, it was the first time in my life, really, where I just wanted to suck up all this knowledge. And towards the end of the degree, I selected a module on psychological disorders, especially many, many different courses and essays on schizophrenia. And I became really interested in schizophrenia. So schizophrenia is a psychiatric condition that's characterised by very debilitating and powerful symptoms such as delusions, which are false beliefs about, for example, other people having malevolent intentions towards oneself, or MI6 following you and that kind of thing, and also hallucinations like hearing voices inside one's head. And I became interested in that, in how the human brain is capable of producing these very powerful and unusual experiences in such a florid and severe way in the case of schizophrenia. I also became interested in why it is that most of us don't have those symptoms. If the brain can produce them, then how is it protecting us, most of us, from not hearing voices? I mean, the idea about hearing voices is that you're really hearing your own thoughts inside your head and misinterpreting them as someone else's voice. So the question is, why don't we do that all the time? How is it that we label our own thoughts as our own and we don't normally misinterpret them as someone else speaking inside our heads? That question really interested me.
And you chose to pursue this interest in schizophrenia both for your PhD and for your postdoctoral research in France. And it was in Paris, this time studying people with the condition, which turned your interest to the teenage brain. What happened?
So what happened was that I was testing all these different patients with schizophrenia. And in the history, I had to ask them various different questions about their illnesses. And one of those questions was, when did you first start experiencing these symptoms? And without a single exception, they all said some age between about 18 and 25. And this really interested me. I mean, we know that. The textbooks tell us this, that schizophrenia is a condition that normally starts at some point in late adolescence, early adulthood. What is it about schizophrenia which remains kind of almost dormant until late adolescence? And what happens in teenage brain development that goes wrong in people who become schizophrenic? That's the question that I really became interested in. And back then, that was about 13 years ago, I looked in the literature thinking that I might find an answer to that question. And to my surprise, back then, there was virtually nothing known even about typical teenage brain development in humans, let alone the development of the brain in teenagers who then go on to become schizophrenic. So that's when I decided that I really, really wanted to look at adolescent brain development.
So 10 years after your school work experience with Uta Frith, and after this postdoc at Paris, you come back now in your mid-20s to work with Uta again. And it was discussions with her that helped you switch fields to research into the teenage brain.
I think there was certainly a big risk, and we had various discussions, and she didn't need a lot of encouragement, but I suppose she might have liked the idea there was a belief in her. I felt very strongly this was going to be a new area. This was going to be something that just was bound to yield very fascinating new findings. And I was delighted that Sarah Jane was interested in taking up precisely this route. And she really more or less succeeded. She more or less created a discipline, a science of adolescence.
I honestly think if it hadn't been for Uta's encouragement, I would not be working on adolescent brain development now, because it was a risk. I had never done a developmental study before. I had only worked on adult patients with schizophrenia. I can even remember where we were when we were sitting down and she was just forcefully encouraging me to go for it and not to worry about the risk.
Give us a sense of how little was known about the teenage brain back then.
The first studies showing that the human brain undergoes this very substantial and significant development throughout adolescence and into the 20s. The first papers were published in the late 90s. Before that, and for example, when I was at university, the dogma in the textbooks was that the vast majority of brain development goes on in the first few years of life and nothing much changes after mid-childhood. That dogma is completely false. But now it's a huge field. There are many, many hundreds of labs probably in the world working in this area, and it's just absolutely thriving.
Professor Sarah Jane Blakemore, in your lab at University College London, you look at decision-making and social cognition in teenagers. What is social cognition, and why are these two areas in particular of interest to you?
Okay, so, well, what I'm really interested in is how social cognition and decision-making interact in adolescence. And what I mean by that is how adolescents make different decisions when they're with their friends compared with when they're on their own. And we know they do. I mean, actually, we all do. We all act differently and behave differently when we're with other people. Like, groups behave differently compared with when those individuals are on their own. That's true at all ages. But for teenagers, that's particularly the case. Teenagers are particularly susceptible to peer influence, and their friends play a very big role in their decision-making processes. And that's what we're really interested in. We look at that by studying social cognition. So that is the way we understand other people, how we understand other people's minds, their intentions, their emotions, what they're about to do. And we look at how the social brain develops. So that is the network of brain regions that we use to understand other people's minds, their mental states, their emotions, that kind of thing, during adolescence. We do this in many different ways, both behaviourally, where we go into schools and we carry out experiments with teenagers in schools, looking at behavioural responses on cognitive tasks, on experimental tasks. And we also bring teenagers into our lab and we give them brain scans to look at how their brain changes, both in terms of its structure, so that is its composition, grey matter and white matter volume, but also its function, so how it activates during different tasks, like, for example, social tasks, where they're thinking about other people's minds, compared with how an adult's brain activates during the same task.
And your work on risk-taking is fascinating. You've found that teenagers are particularly susceptible to the driving fast, smoking, drug-taking and generally risky behaviour that, you know, some parents of teenagers might be familiar with. Why is that?
I think teenagers are probably quite sort of famous, stereotype for taking risks. Now, of course, not all teenagers take risks. We have to start with that because there are loads of individual differences and it gets kind of frustrating when we make these generalisations about all teenagers do this, all teenagers do that. However, there is a heightened tendency for teenagers to take risks compared with other age groups. That's for sure. We know that from huge amounts of epidemiological data. What's really interesting to me is the situations in which teenagers tend to take risks. And more often than not, it's when they're with their friends. And it's a consequence of peer influence. Therefore, it's the interaction, it's the way these two things come together, risk-taking and peer influence, that really interests me. Teenagers will do things when they're with their friends that they would not dream of doing when they're on their own. And we're trying to understand why that is. And what I don't want to do is try to kind of somehow dismiss it as a bad behaviour that needs to be eliminated. I think these behaviours are really important. The natural propensity for teenagers to take risks must be there for an evolutionary reason.
And is there something in their brains that's also undergoing some structural transformation at this time?
There's a pretty established theory of risk-taking, the biological basis of risk-taking, which is that two different systems in the brain developed at different rates. The parts of the brain called the limbic system, which includes the regions of the brain that give you a rewarding feeling out of taking a risk, a kind of kick out of taking a risk, and an emotion out of taking a risk, are developing more quickly than the part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which inhibits risk-taking. So there's a sort of mismatch in their developmental trajectories. So the idea there is that if the system that gives you the kick out of risk-taking is developed before the system that inhibits risk-taking, then that's going to increase the tendency to take risks because you get the great feeling out of it and you don't yet have the fully developed ability to stop yourself taking risks.
So teenagers have quite a hard time, really, and yet they don't get much sympathy from us, do they?
Something that I've noticed since working with teenagers is that they are the butt of many jokes and they're parodied left, right and centre. They're demonised in newspapers. And whenever I tweet anything about the teenage brain, which I do quite frequently, invariably, inevitably, I'll get a reply from someone going, oh, what, teenagers actually have brains, that kind of thing. And it is kind of funny because in society, for some reason, this is totally acceptable. But what's strange is that if you think about making those kinds of jokes about any other sector of society, like if you just made jokes about, I don't know, like women or based on race in that kind of institutionalised way that we do about teenagers, it just would not be acceptable. I can't understand why this is still acceptable.
And your work has attracted the interest of government and policymakers because of the potential implications for how we teach children and teenagers. Professor Tanya Byron is a clinical psychologist in child and adolescent mental health. She believes your work is critical for both education and the mental health of teenagers.
Sarah Jane's work is vital, I would say, and I don't think that's overstating it in terms of how we think about education policy for children and young people. She's shone a spotlight on the adolescent brain. She's showed us it's a period of neuroplasticity, of sensitivity, of opportunity. She challenges the prevailing notion that really the only investment we can make in the 0 to 3 years, that that's when you'll make a difference in terms of outcomes for children. And actually in terms of education and other areas of child and adolescent mental health as well. As much as she'd hate me to say it, I'd say she really is spearheading research that we're years behind and we need to catch up on. And that has a profound impact for children and young people moving forward.
And that's really nice to hear.
And what were you talking to government about?
Most recently, it was about considering adolescence as a period of development that required and deserved government funding. Because as Tanya says, most funding is aimed towards the 0 to 3 years. And there's a lot of reason for that. There's economic arguments that they are the years that produce the most added value if you fund those. The problem is that many children, for example, from very disadvantaged backgrounds will slip through the net and they won't get that additional intervention and funding early on. And the idea that somehow, oh, well, if they've slipped through the net and you've missed them early on, then it's too late to change is totally against what we know about how the adolescent brain develops and is still developing right throughout the teenage years and even into the 20s. It's not too late to intervene and to rehabilitate, if you like. I don't know how far that's gone, though, in terms of policy decisions and funding, which is the critical question, of course.
Well, given that it's now clear that the brain is still developing during adolescence, you're currently looking at whether there might be a sensitive period, an optimum time for learning certain things.
Yeah, so this is a new research project that we've been doing over the last 18 months. It's a huge project which takes place in dozens of schools in London and around London, where we go into schools and we look at learning at different ages. And what we're really interested in is whether there are certain ages where children are particularly susceptible to learning new information. And the information that we're testing is kind of abstract information, the kind of information that you'd use for non-verbal reasoning or for certain types of maths. And the idea is that because the regions of the brain that process those kinds of abstract information are undergoing such a lot of development and reorganisation in early adolescence, maybe early adolescence represents a period of kind of heightened plasticity, a sensitive period for learning, for acquiring that kind of information. We're still collecting data. We've collected data from hundreds and hundreds of children and adolescents so far. So we've got huge amounts of data, but we're still collecting it and we haven't analysed it yet. But depending on what we find, the results could have implications for education, like when to teach what, when is the best age to teach certain types of lessons, like
It sounds like it could revolutionise education if you do really find these windows of opportunity.
Well, I don't know if it'll revolutionise it. Of course, it will have to replicated and everything, but yeah, I mean, it could have real implications.
You know, what are the other implications of your work for how we educate teenagers?
So talking to teachers and parents and sometimes students in schools, what I tend to do is I just tell them about the research. I just tell them about how the adolescent brain is developing. For example, we know that the prefrontal cortex undergoes very substantial and protracted development during adolescence. The prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain right at the front, just behind the forehead. It's bigger than in humans than in other species, and it's involved in a whole range of very high-level cognitive tasks, such as decision-making and planning and inhibiting inappropriate behaviour and self-awareness and social interaction. One of the functions it's involved in is planning what you're going to do tonight or next week or even in 5 years' time. And we know that this region is undergoing very, very large amounts of development during the adolescent years. And so in terms of the expectations that we place on teenagers to, for example, plan their homework, plan their GCSE projects, might be too much, given that we know that the region of the brain that critically involved in planning is not developed yet.
Sarah Jane Blakemore was your surname, given your father's a prominent scientist, was your surname in any way an advantage or possibly even a hindrance in your own career early on?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It's one that I've thought about a lot. So it's sometimes been a bit difficult being someone whose dad is very, very prominent in a very similar field in a small country. Most neuroscientists in this country know who my dad is, have heard of him. And that has sometimes been hard because I feel like I'm sort of walking in his shadow a lot. Of course, I have to acknowledge there have been huge advantages. Like, for example, during my gap year between school and university, one of the things I did was work in some neuroscience labs in California, and that was organised through my dad. Mm. And it was a huge advantage. I mean, I got real hands-on neuroscience experience for 3 months. That would have been very, very difficult to have organised by myself. So I completely acknowledge and appreciate the advantages of having a dad in the same field. There have never been any overt disadvantages, I don't think. I can't think of any examples where I've really felt like it's a disadvantage. It's more of a kind of, when I was younger, when I was doing my PhD and postdocs, I was a bit worried that I would be judged to be in his shadow and I'd be compared with him. And that's really hard because he's so, you know, successful. And
well, have you been? I mean, you're not doing so badly yourself.
I think things have changed recently. I'm a bit older now and I've kind of established my own lab and my work is known independently, of course, from his. And that really has changed things. I feel much more comfortable talking about him and the fact that, yes, he's my dad and acknowledging that now. But I think now that I have established my lab and acquired my own funding and published a lot in my own area, I feel a bit more confident that people will be judging me on my own merit and not attributing that to any kind of unfair advantage.
Well, it's very clear, Sarah Jane, that you love your work. So do you find time for other interests?
I do. I mean, my work is my passion and I, you know, sometimes I think of it as my hobby, which slightly freaks me out. because whenever I have a spare moment, I just desperate to get to my work. But on the other hand, I do have a family. And I love spending time with my sons. We live in the countryside and we love being out in the countryside, going for walks in the forests and in the Chilterns, my favourite activity. We do lots of family things. I spend a lot of time with friends. I really value friendships and have friends who go back many decades. So, yeah, I do a lot of other things outside my work, but I do love my work.
If there was one thing you could go back in time and tell your teenage self, what would it be?
That's quite a difficult question. Well, I'm going to slightly sidestep that question and say that as a teenager, I would have found it enormously helpful to know that my brain was undergoing a lot of development and that things would settle down. And that all the teenage typical behaviours that my friends and I got up to were part and parcel of teenage brain development and that they wouldn't last forever. You know, back then, teenage typical behaviour and things like mood swings and neurosis, anxiety, that kind of thing, were put down to changes in hormones mostly. We now understand them in terms of changes in the brain, and I think that would have been hugely helpful to know about when I was a teenager, which is why people in my group and I often go into schools to give talks to teenagers to tell them about what's going on in their brains.
Sarah Jane Blakemore, thank you for letting us hear your Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast of the Life Scientific. For more information or to listen to other episodes, please search for the Life Scientific on the Radio 4 website.